Ah, yes, indeed. Welcome again to The Age Stage. Great to have you company. This is RPPFM, of course, broadcasting across the Mornington Peninsula on 98.7 and 98.3. The Age Stage, a program in which we look at matters affecting older Australians, made possible by the Village Baxter, the Village Glen, and Encore Living for that rural alternative. I'm Brendan Telfer, and joining me today, as usual, in the studio, Paula Dunn. Welcome, Paula. Welcome again.
Hello, Brendan. Good to be here.
Good to be here, Paula, and we're just about on the first day of spring.
So we are. Won't that be wonderful?
Wonderful. Oh. Looking forward to it. We've had an interesting old week or two, haven't we, down here on the Mornington Peninsula? But good to see you here, so thank you very much indeed. And time to introduce once again our guests who join us each and every week for the Age Stage. And joining us today, Peter Nilsson and also Stuart Shaw. Gentlemen, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Morning, good morning Paul. On the eve of spring, and let me share something with you.
Please, Peter.
Later today.
Thursday.
Yes. Yes. Jumping on the paraffin budgie, heading off to All Points North, Europe, with my wife.
Wow.
Oh, lucky.
So I'm gone for 6 weeks.
Wow.
Oh,
six weeks.
Can I drive your car?
You can't.
Can I drive
your car? I will.
Can I drive the car while you're away? I can polish it for you, mister.
Which one? He's got a consortium of cars.
These beautiful. Well, that's marvellous. We'll have a wonderful time. And it's a great time as well to be in Europe, actually.
I see you're phoning in from somewhere.
Please do. We have the technology. But what a perfect time to be in Europe. We digress, of course. Mm. But just the last week of August, the first few weeks of September, the crowds have gone. Yep. It's still warm. Yep. Everything's still open.
Autumn.
Beautiful.
And that it's just turning slightly in Europe. You're a very lucky and a very clever man, Mr. Nilsson.
Thank you.
I'll tell anybody that listens. Paula, we were reflecting before these guys came in on what a great week we had last week with the minister.
We did.
If you weren't with us, we indeed had the Minister for Aged Care on the program, a special that Stuart hosted over at the Village Baxter, so it was lovely to get over there. But also to meet the minister as well. You guys had recommended him to us. You said that we would be impressed. And we're trying to keep politics out of this.
Yeah.
We don't want to get involved editorially in that. But just in terms of his impact of a human being.
Yeah, he was an authentic man. That's how I felt. He was genuinely interested, I think, in you know, aged care. And that came through. That really did come through.
And he resonated with your personal observations about your dad your journey as well.
Yes, he did. Yeah, and he was very... I felt he was very compassionate. Mm. Yeah.
He's a thinker.
He is a thinker.
And he's genuine.
Absolutely.
That's why we're really keen to try and take the opportunity for him to speak on radio because... Mm. You know, his voice should be heard around the country.
It should be.
Yeah, so, I agree.
I wonder why we don't hear more of him.
Yes.
Why don't we see more of a profile? I mean, he's a guy that has sort of gravitas. He's very eloquent. He speaks extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we seeing more of him from a cabinet point of view or from a government point of view?
Mm.
I wonder.
Probably, I think, maybe that his topic, people don't want to hear the good news. They want to hear the bad news, don't they?
So, yes, probably.
Yeah, so there's lots happening in the political spectrum Australia-wide, isn't there, at the moment?
There is.
A lot of it is just noise, in my view. Whereas what he's got to bring to the table is quality. And he's pushing the agenda of caring for older Australians quite hard. And he's mindful of budgets and things. So I'm thinking he's doing a marvellous job. I loved his idea about the gap year.
Yes, wasn't that great? Yes, a gap year before you retire.
In fact, I said to Chaz today that I'm taking my gap year on.
my gap, six weeks. What did Chaz respond?
He looked at me blankly.
Awesome.
Yes. So does that mean that Chaz hadn't listened to the show? And
no, he didn't get my drift, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Well, you'll have to work on that.
We will.
Yeah, take the gap year before you ponder retiring. Then we'll know when you're planning on retiring.
Yes. Mm. You come back and you've changed your mind, according to Ken.
But Stuart, it was good to see him over there in the context of your establishment, your residences as well, and that he involves himself at that level and can make himself available. I mean, again, here's a minister doing that, you know?
Yeah, look, he is very generous with his time, and if he believes that there's a good cause... And people can learn from him. I think he's prepared to go out of his way to participate. Mm-hmm. And he certainly made that clear to us.
He did. We were thrilled, weren't we, to give our guests, the middle management on the peninsula of the three sectors that we work in, the home care, residential aged care and retirement living, those middle managers, the forum to sit with the minister, and I think they were pretty nonplussed, weren't they?
Yeah, because people like that never get a chance to actually talk to the decision maker and share the frustrations. Mm. And that's what it was about. Ken is really keen to listen to what's happening in the real world.
Mm.
Forget in the political world or the bureaucracy or anything else. What's happening on the ground and how can we make it better?
Mm.
And I think that's the real strength, that someone who wants to listen and can then influence the ultimate decisions being made by the bureaucrats. So I thought that was really quite special for the attendees.
Mm.
And I agree with Peter that, you know, normally it's the guys in suits, but you and I, who might get the chance to meet with the minister.
Mm.
But the majority of the people who sat in the audience before the show last week do not normally have that opportunity. They can go to a conference and pay a lot of money to sit in an audience of 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 people and be spoken to by a minister or a politician giving an address. But that's not engagement. Engagement occurs locally.
If we can get political for a moment, I'm sure his political rivals would say, well, it's all very well, he can talk the talk, but can he deliver the talk as well? Are the policies getting out there? My aged care, are we going to see some reform there, do you think?
Mm.
That's the test.
Mm. Yeah.
They've certainly made a huge financial commitment to my aged care, and I think Stuart's views are well known on that.
They are.
Yeah.
So, and clearly there are lots of frustrated people dealing with my aged care. There is a lot of work to do. I think if Stuart had his way, we would start again, wouldn't we?
We would.
Well, it sounds like it's just full of bugs at the moment.
My aged care is a reasonable concept up to a point, but it tries to go beyond that point. It should be an information venue for consumers and providers, but it should not go beyond that to then seek to allocate and control the destiny of people.
Mm.
Leave that to the local professionals on the ground and they can determine that. You know, because that's why it used to be. If you want to see a list of providers available in an area, by all means, go to the website and have a look. But then you're still going to go out and have a look at what the facility is actually like.
Mm,
you're never
right.
going to just choose an aged care place or a retirement village by looking at a website.
No, never.
You want to know, you know, does it actually exist?
Yeah.
Because anything, as we know, on the web, I received an email from Qantas this morning asking me to be a mystery shopper. And I looked at the reply to address. I deleted the email. Whilst I would love to have been a mystery flyer to go to places international and give feedback, you know, it was clearly a hoax.
Mm.
And, you know, the internet of all things needs to have some greater rigour to act as a showcase for organisations, but you're never going to make a commitment. It's not, I'm going to sign up on the basis of a website.
Mm.
Fair?
Yeah, that's fair, yeah. And unfortunately, we are in the people business. Always have been, always will be. My aged care takes people out of the equation. It's a portal. Yeah.
Yes, it is a portal.
And you can't talk to anybody.
No.
It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
I'm relatively computer literate, but you go to some badly designed website or portals where you follow the bouncing ball in a number of steps. The people who design the software, if they miss a step, we all trip up. And there's lots of missteps in my aged care.
Mm. One of the things that Ken spoke about, I think it was during the presentation rather than the broadcast, was the fact that government is now pushing more and more things into their computer portals. And that's a problem for consumers.
Stuart, it really is a problem for all sorts of reasons. Yeah, let's start with our cohort are not people who are used to doing in-depth searching of websites, just not used to it.
Mm. Yeah.
And the old rule of thumb is any more than two clicks to find what you want, forget it.
Well, no one's going to troll through pages and pages of scripts about this, that and the other. No one.
No.
Doesn't matter what age you are.
So, you know, so there are things that government need to consider as they move forward on any of their policy directions. Centrelink, health, I mean, you now need to have your My Health record online to get a refund from Medicare, whereas you used to just get a check in the mail or your GP would claim it directly and you all moved on. But to actually now have to have My Health linked up to MyGov is just a really complex way for many of the consumers in particular age cohorts to actually cope with.
Yes.
So the consensus is a great start by the minister. There's a lot on his plate. It's a huge area. Yep. I mean, it really is. It's a major national issue, this, and he has a massive responsibility to deliver from no matter what side of politics. Mm. The demographics in the country are huge, and the consequences of getting it wrong are also equally huge, are they not?
Well, they are, because I think the general public would link whatever political colours in power to the website, and even though it's not their fault as politicians, if the website's not working for you,
they're taking ownership.
It's the government's fault. The government are the Liberals or Labor, and it's their fault. Mm. So there's a, as Stuart has said before, there's a fair bit at stake and there's a fair risk
for
the government.
And there's the accountability of the sector as well, which we also touched on with Avio, of course, as well, which I think he was prepared to have a good, strong look at.
Yep.
But these are issues, obviously, on his plate and the responsibilities that he has.
Mm.
Brendan, one of the things that both sides of politics seem to support is the broad thrust of where the industry should be going. And I think certainly Ken has committed that whatever he's going to do with the portfolio, he will talk with his opposition member to make certain that that person is on board, so that together, as politicians should be working together, that they can try and do something that will actually work for consumers and for providers. And I think that is equally one of Ken's particular strengths that he didn't actually mention last week. But he will work with the opposition on any particular topic, and he will work especially on his Indigenous Affairs portfolio. He will ensure that the opposition is fully appraised of what he's doing to make certain there's broad agreement. And I think that, I mean, in an ideal world, I think that's what our view of politics is, that whoever's in power should be working with the opposition to design a system that is going to work for the benefit of a country.
Mm.
That is the aspiration, I'm sure. Just a reminder, you're tuned up to RPPFM. This is The Age Stage across the Mornington Peninsula and well beyond. We're going to take a break, pay a few bills, and when we come back, more. And yes, you are tuned up to RPPFM. The Age Stage is what you're listening to today. Great to have your company. Brendan Telfer, Paula Dunn in the studio with you today. And we're also hosting from the Village Baxter and Village Glen, our regular contributors. We have Stuart and Peter in the studio with us today. Before the break, we were talking, Peter, about the minister, who, of course, we kindly met with last week, but interesting days ahead, I think, for him.
Absolutely, can I change the topic for a little bit?
Why don't you change the topic?
One of the things that's on our radar today is that the minister's... The Minister McCormack, who's the Federal Minister for Small Business, and one of his interests is the corporates and ACCC, but also consumer affairs. So as part of, I presume it's the COAG process, would it be, Stuart?
I think it is part of that process whereby
which is the Council of Australian Governments. They get together with their colleagues. The host of the Consumer Affairs Portfolios Australia-wide today is Victoria. And so in Victoria, Minister McCormack is meeting with all of the consumer affairs ministers from each state and territory. And we have it on good authority, Stuart, don't we, that a major topic is retirement villages.
Ah.
And those terrible terms we've been hearing about is, you know, gouging and ripping older people off, and you mentioned before Aveo, which was the Four Corners program.
Indeed. Is this an upshot of that, do you think?
It is. Absolutely, it is.
Wow. So they've moved really quickly then.
Oh, they have. Well, Stuart and I had the good fortune to be in Canberra for a meeting of our colleagues with Minister McCormick and with Minister Wyatt.
Yes.
Minister Wyatt asked a number of us to join him to talk about the Four Corners program, because at that stage there was a fair bit of media suggesting that because the retirement sector is legislated by the states and territories rather than by the federal government.
And he mentioned that last week when he joined us, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And there was a perception amongst some that because the system, the perceptions I'm talking here, the perception is that the system is not working, that maybe the federal should take over the control. And Minister Wyatt indicated that that was not the Commonwealth's wish, but it was their wish to harmonise legislation Australia-wide and to act as a facilitator Australia-wide to make sure that, in the consumer sense, the residents of our villages are well looked after and protected.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The reality of the world is that people who choose to live in a retirement village are happy with their choice. They are quite capable of making that decision. They are not people who need to be protected in any particular way. They are independent retirees who have elected to live in a particular environment that works for them. It's still only 5% of older people, and we need to keep that in mind. And the vast majority of those people, 97, 98, 99% of those people, are thrilled with their decision making. They will, you know, always have some issues with particular providers or people who didn't deliver what it could deliver for them. And those people need to have a good, strong complaints process that has some teeth to it.
So, and is that what's missing, Stuart? The complaints?
It's actually not missing.
No.
Process? No, you know, when you look at the Four Corners story, you know, about AVIO.
That's another story for another day. That, yeah. I mean, that program, if you wanted to dissect it, was a very poor piece of journalism.
Mm.
We only ever heard one side of the story. Mm-hmm. But on the disputes, one of the things our industry has done since that meeting, 4 weeks ago, Stuart, is the industry has gotten together with each of the sectors. Now I'm talking the Retirement Living Council, which is one of the sectors, or one of the peak bodies.
One of the peak bodies, yes.
The other one is ACSA, and the other one is LASA. The three of those bodies have got together in a loose arrangement, and the Retirement Living Council have put forward an 8-point plan mm-hmm. to address a number of issues that were raised by the minister and raised by journalists.
So yeah. These would be nationally implemented regulation or control of some sort, would it? And it would come from the federal government?
No, the theory is that the federal government, anyway, are of a view that the industry should be empowered to self-regulate. And the 8-point plan is part of a self-regulation plan. Some of them are standard contracts Australia-wide, a code of conduct that's enforceable, a dispute resolution that's actually run and managed by the industry, not by government. Because what we're finding is each of the states and territories have some form of dispute resolution in their consumer legislation for villages, unfunded. So the big problem is if someone has a complaint, it's prescribed what we should do with it. And Victoria has a very good...
It does, through Consumer Affairs.
Very good... The problem is that if it gets elevated past the village, we have guidelines how disputes should be resolved. And bearing in mind, lots of disputes are not resident versus manager or owner of village, it's resident versus resident. That can happen. And those things, those type disputes are difficult to manage at the village level sometimes. And there is a way you can escalate it to Consumer Affairs and finally end up in VCAT. However, that's not funded. So when things get a bit out of hand, unless there's someone prepared to pay for things to happen, so what the government are saying is you are the industry, you are the ones who know your product, you're the ones who know your residents, you're the ones we think should manage and run a robust dispute resolution system.
But is that the government absolving itself of some responsibility here and sheeting home responsibility to you guys in the sector?
I don't think so. Yeah. I hold the view, I suppose from that point of view, if I was an American, I'd be a Republican. From that point of view, is small government, in my view, is good, because the problem with having very restrictive legislation is it stifles innovation. If you have to do things in a certain way, well, you have to do them in that way, and that's the end of it. Whereas if the industry self-regulates, and as you know, and we talked about last week, there's nothing more certain than change. Things are always changing. Our industry's developed a number of ways over the last 30 and 40 years, hasn't it, Stuart? And it's changed because we're driven by the consumer and what their needs and wants are.
Could you not have it like an ombudsman for aged care?
You could, and that's on the table. That's one of the points on the table, because the 8-point plan has come about by dealing with our clients, and our clients, being residents of villages, have resident associations representing them, and they are pushing for an ombudsman. But once again, Paula, an ombudsman, yes, that would be a good thing. How do you fund it?
Funding.
Yeah. Funding is a really important part.
But you can imagine the pushback, can't you, from those people that were sort of throwing their hands up in the air and saying, woe is me, when they saw that Four Corners program, that the provider is now self-regulating. They're going to be saying, this is the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah.
Well,
how can you people be trusted? Look what you're doing. It's a travesty.
Well,
and
funnily enough, if we go back 15 or so years, Stuart, when you and I were babes in this industry.
Excuse me, laughing.
If we go back then, I can recall a time where the RVA Victoria had a dispute resolution system as part of accreditation, and it was self-regulated. One of the members of our panel was the Director of Consumer Affairs Victoria, and we had a panel of life members, former presidents and life members of our industry, were the body you appealed to. And those would be two or three men, typically men at that stage, where if you had a dispute, they would be sitting there, not in judgment so much as giving their experience how we can resolve this dispute.
Yeah. And by having consumer affairs as a part of that process, that they were able to give some view about the credibility as to how the dispute had been resolved. But in the time that that system functioned, I think it had a 100% success rate. And you know, that's not to say that we would always side with the operator. You know, I fondly remember a dear friend out in the eastern suburbs, where my advice to him was the client, being the resident, was perfectly reasonable in what they were seeking. And my ultimate position was they should sell their business before they ruin it, because they were not suitable operators of the village. So, you know, I think what we tried to do was be fair to everybody. That, you know, it's not, you know, if we think an operator is being sheer bloody minded because, you know, for whatever reason, we'll call that out.
Well, today then, you confront some of these issues, and you'll be drawn together to discuss it. And so
we're not part of that process.
Oh, I see. But it will be happening later on today.
Yes, the process is the ministers and their advisors getting together as a collegiate to discuss a way forward.
Can you see any? You say that Victoria, we here, are protected by good legislation in this state. Can you see any pushback in other states? Is there no reason why other states would not want to join or be inspired by the legislation in this state, for instance?
Well,
on these matters, would the pushback be coming from, if there is any?
Well, unfortunately, people take ownership of what they write.
Yes, under the federation process,
and sometimes when that's a good word, bloody monitors. Sometimes. When you start with a piece of paper written by someone who's got ownership of the piece of paper, they're very inflexible to change, because it's sort of their idea.
Yes. And,
but on that point, though, one of the things that that is happening with the process today, I certainly hope, is they're going to discuss the eight-point plan, and they're going to try to find a way to, as I say, harmonise the legislation Australia-wide. And so I'm thinking today is going to be the start of a process. I'm not sure there's going to be any answers from today.
You'd like to think they'd set, you know, the key goals. Okay, what do consumers need to know? How much money they're going to get when they leave? Fundamental number one. Can they read the contract? Fundamental number two. You know, does it need to be 170 pages? No, it doesn't. You know, there are some really fundamental issues that they could agree upon. And even if they don't copy the legislation from other states, providing it meets those criteria, move forward.
Stuart, are you a glass half full or half empty? Do you see, have you got an optimistic view that there will be common sense?
I do have an optimistic view that common sense will prevail. Being a Victorian, I actually would think the other states would do well to look at our act. I think it works particularly well. Can is there it work a, better?
Have they put a timeline on it? Like, is that, like, it's all good and well to have lots of meetings and things on agendas and, you know, ideas and things, but when do, you know, what's the timeline that they've given
I would think if they can agree on the fundamental thrust as to what they want to do, then that could actually happen fairly quickly because the work would come back to the industry and the peak bodies to say, this is, we've listened to our members, we've listened to our clients, and this is the way we think we should move forward.
And what's fairly quickly mean? Does that mean months, years?
I would say that could occur in months.
A code of conduct is something that could be done relatively quickly.
There might be a political imperative for them to do that as well, with elections imminent and trying to get some good news out here.
Compulsory accreditation will take longer because clearly that's quite a process.
Yes.
And I'm thinking timelines for that would be, if we said, okay, from today, within 3 years, everyone who is a member of those peaks must be fully accredited by the peak. What you do with people who choose not to be members of anything, I don't know. That's an issue that has to be
dealt
with.
But that ends up being the choice of a consumer.
Yeah.
If you want to go with an organisation that's not accredited, then you understand you're taking a higher degree of risk in that. And I think consumers should have that choice.
We're defending the rights of the consumer here on the age stage. And it's what age stage is all about, really. And but, Peter, you are disappearing over the horizon because while COAG meets, you'll be able to read about it when you're long, long away.
Oh, having a pina colada at 30,000 feet.
Oh, good on you, Peter.
How nice is that?
Think of us. Think of us, please.
I guarantee you he will not think of us. I'm pretty certain that he'll be singly focused.
Well, Stuart, hopefully you will, and maybe you can come back and give us a little bit of a heads up on what is happening later on today when we meet again at the same time next week.
We'll need to talk about that as well, Brendan.
Stuart, that would be super. That would be fantastic. That'll be great. We're going to wrap it up here because, Peter, it's time for us to wish you bon voyage. Enjoy your holiday.
Au revoir.
And thank you very much.
Au revoir, Peter.
Au revoir. Wow.
Bon nuit.
Stuart, hopefully you will be with us next week, will you not, Stuart?
He says, yes, you will, Stuart.
No, I might have a prior agreement, prior arrangement.
Wow, could be an interesting
it
week
could
next
be.
Week.
But Kim will be able to step in.
Beautiful.
And Jane or maybe Katie or even Katie, Damien.
Yeah, Katie.
I haven't met Damien yet. He's the operations manager for aged care.
Okay.
Excellent. He's a really well-respected guy.
Yeah. Certainly Kim is available next week.
And I have to say that I think Ken Wyatt, the minister, was really excited about the age stage. I think he really thought we were doing a really good service to the community, which we think we are. It was good to get that sort of encouragement from him. Yeah.
And thank you for facilitating that as well, the both of you. We appreciate it very much indeed. This is the age stage on RPPFM. When we come back, we're going to be discussing medical issues and indeed vaccination for older Australians. Well, next on to our next guest. He's the Deputy Chief of Health for Victoria. He's Dr. Brett Sutton. And Brett Sutton is very worried about vaccination rates, and in particular on the age stage, of course. We're very interested in vaccination rates and the way it affects older Australians. Brett, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the age stage.
Pleasure.
Brett, we obviously looking in the program at older Australians, the impact of health and issues for them.
Tell us a little bit about what impact and what the trends are in terms of vaccination for older Australians. Are they with it or are they against it?
I think they're largely with it. Unlike, you know, a core anti-vaccination group that are mostly focused on the childhood immunisation schedule, I think elderly Australians largely see that it's protective for them, and they're looking to, you know, make sure that it's available and that they can access it. The challenge is more so for elderly Australians is that because it's not embedded in, you know, routine visits like the childhood immunisation schedule and not embedded in council vaccination programs, it becomes a little bit harder. They tend to get picked up and received in GP consultations, and even though most people would see their GP at least once a year, they're not always thought about for all of those consultations. But I think, you know, there's generally very good support for vaccination, but there's not as great as awareness as there could be.
What vulnerabilities then is there for older Australians if they choose not to vaccinate or have not vaccinated in their younger years, oversight or perhaps not in a position to get on a program if they're more recently arrived in Australia?
It really does depend on the individual vaccine. For a lot of people, if you've gone through your childhood and depending on your country of origin, happen not to have got the full vaccine schedule, for some it doesn't much matter because they will have acquired it in childhood overseas. So hepatitis A, which you might get as a travel vaccine, you know, if you were born overseas, you know, 70 years ago, you're very likely to have been exposed to hepatitis A. For measles, mumps and rubella, the same. If you didn't get that as a child 70 years ago, not an issue. It wasn't available as a vaccine, and you're very likely to have picked it up in your childhood. But for some of the others, the ones that are made available on the national schedule, for example, varicella vaccine for shingles and the pneumococcal and influenza vaccines that are all made free for various age groups are important ones to get, and it would be dangerous not to get them. There are others that are part of the childhood vaccine, like tetanus, that it is important to get right throughout your life, and if you missed out as a child, you know, the message is it's never too late. You should get immunised for tetanus, for example, if you've never been immunised, because it's a bacteria that lives in the environment and it only takes being exposed at any time in your life to potentially develop tetanus, which is a very serious illness, as we know.
Talking about the environment, are you seeing any strains or bacteria or perhaps epidemics that are more prevalent these days given changes to the environmental conditions we are now living in?
Certainly, I think the biggest societal change, I guess not so much environmental, but it does relate to global changes, and that's travel. So we definitely see more disease that relates to people either on short-term trips out of Australia or short-term trips into Australia who are picking up diseases that we wouldn't otherwise be seeing in Australia. So all of our measles cases in Australia are essentially linked to international travel. We have eliminated measles in terms of locally transmitting in Australia for the last few years. So any measles case that we do see in Australia has all been imported, if you like, people visiting Southeast Asia, people visiting India and coming back and spreading measles from there. So that's one big trend. Some of the other ones really relate to the kind of changes that people have undergone in terms of the way the vaccine's been constituted. The old diphtheria, tetanus and pertussis vaccine, the so-called triple antigen vaccine, used to be a whole cell vaccine, like a mushed up bacteria that was given and would create quite a lot of local reaction. That vaccine has been reconstituted in its modern form so that it doesn't have quite so much in the way of a local reaction and fever. It used to cause quite a bit of discomfort and fever. Now the vaccine is much better tolerated, but it doesn't have the you know, the depth of protection and the level of protection that the old triple antigen vaccine provided. And so we do see, we still see whooping cough spikes, you know, little epidemics every few years by virtue of not having the, you know, a vaccine that was problematic anymore. So it's a balance. You know, you try and get a vaccine that provides adequate protection, but that doesn't cause, you know, side effects that, turn people off the vaccine ultimately.
The exposure to these sorts of infections, I guess, are reasonably rare. In terms of your campaigns to educate us about what we should be doing, you seem to be quite prolific and you certainly seem to be getting the message out there. Are you comfortable with how you are imparting that message?
I think so. It's true that they're not always common, but some of it flies under the radar. People probably don't know that influenza kills more people than almost any other, you know, hazard in Australia every year. In Victoria alone, there's probably 700 or 800 deaths every year from the flu. You know, if that were happening with bushfires or some other hazard, we'd, you know, we'd be reading it on the front pages. But because it happens every season, we don't have that level of awareness. So I think there's always a piece of work to do in terms of making sure that anyone who is eligible is picking it up, and we certainly try very hard, but we know that there's probably only a third of people who are eligible to pick up some of these vaccines who actually receive them in the elderly age groups, and so we want to continue to work to make sure that people, especially those at high risk because of medical conditions or frailty or immune system not working as well as it should, you know, they in particular need to make sure that they get these critical vaccines.
And that would basically come back to good advice and a good health professional. Tell me, Brett, fix up a conundrum for me. How can a current vaccine protect us against a mutating flu virus, for instance, that's had 12 months to evolve in the period since the vaccine was first designed?
Yeah, so we have this kind of cooperation between the northern and southern hemispheres. We look at what's circulating in the northern hemisphere. They do testing on all of their flu cases to try and see what the majority strains are during their season, which is over our summer. And then we make our vaccine strain choices for our upcoming season on the basis of really what's been circulating in the northern hemisphere 6 months earlier. And so we really try and make a best guess at the kind of strains that should make up the vaccine to try and cover the circulating strains.
You mentioned how difficult, you know, flu can be and what a killer it has been. And historically, of course, particularly after the First World War, there was a massive epidemic that wiped out many millions of people. Are we still vulnerable to such an infection globally these days, or is our medical science up to it?
We're certainly vulnerable to a pandemic. That's what happened in 1918, and that was a result of a major mutation in the flu virus. And a pandemic is really an epidemic that goes around the world because everyone globally is vulnerable to that particular flu virus. The seasonal flu that we get every year is just the minor changes that happen every 12 months. But a pandemic does happen on average every 25, 30 years. Our most recent one was 2009. The one in 1918 was obviously an absolute killer, but it was also before the era of penicillin and antibiotics and intensive care. And so I'm sure we could protect our populations much better than could be done in 1918. But it's still entirely possible that we could get a pandemic flu virus that's really quite severe. We'd certainly have tens of thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands or millions of cases in Australia whenever a pandemic comes around. But we, you know, we have to hope that we have a milder version and that we can make sure that people get the care that they need when the system's under severe pressure.
Well, we don't want to alarm too many people in the aid stage today, but essentially, I guess what you're communicating here for us, Brett, is just stay close to your doctor, take some good advice, and if they're saying that you should be vaccinating against particular flu outbreaks and or other more rare and exotic diseases, take medical advice and get to it.
That's right. So everyone over 65 years of age should get the influenza vaccine every year, the pneumococcal vaccine to protect against pneumonia in particular, and should also consider the shingles vaccine if they're 70 years or catch up if they haven't had it, and between 71 and 79 years. So they're the main ones. And also for Indigenous Australians, that pneumococcal and vaccines available from 50 years of age, and the same for flu.
Dr. Brett Sutton, we've taken too much of your time. We appreciate it today, and thank you so much indeed for joining us on the Aid Stage. Most interesting, fascinating area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. This is RPP FM. You're listening to the Aid Stage on 98.7 and 98.3. We're streaming and we're heard around the world as well. And all this, of course, made possible by our very good friends at the Village Baxter, Village Glen, and Encore Living as well. Travel. Older Australians, they're doing a lot of it. More of them and more of us are travelling. They're going to more exotic locations and destinations. To find out a little bit more about all this, from National Seniors Travel is Tracy Rivers. She's on the line. Tracy, hello. Welcome to RPPFM.
Thank you.
Tracy, we are travelling more, aren't we, as a group, older Australians?
Absolutely. In fact, 34.6% in 2016 of all short-term travellers in Australia were over 50, a huge increase from the last 5 years.
It's incredible. So what explains it? Why are we travelling more, do you think?
I think that the reason why older Australians are travelling is because they, part of the baby boomers, they're all reached that age. They've got quite a bit of disposable income, most of us, or some of them, and they want to, I suppose, reclaim their youth a little bit and do the things that they did when they were a bit younger. They were the first, those hippies, and they do tending to travel a little bit more to see the world.
So off the beaten path, then, is their usual destination. Is that right? Are you seeing those sorts of trends?
A bit of both, really. South America is one of the places that we have really seen increased growth. And the other place that we have really seen increased growth is in Iceland, people wanting to see the Northern Lights. We do have a lot of people that do want to travel using, I suppose, more conventional methods of travel, i.e. coach touring, but that's dropped off quite a bit. In fact, that's probably one of the biggest areas that has dropped off is coach touring as much. We are finding that younger Australians are wanting to do that, and the older Australians are more interested in going to different places and seeing different things.
Wow, that's an incredible role reversal, isn't it? Because usually you would associate the bus tours with the oldies and the more exotic destinations with the youngies. That's quite incredible. But on the telly, I'm seeing all these wonderful destinations, and I'm seeing lots of people sort of cycling through French villages and getting back on barges or river tours, and the big European rivers being opened up to tourism. Are we seeing much of that from Aussies as well?
Oh, absolutely. That's been one of the biggest growth areas. River cruising is such a fantastic way of travelling through Europe. Easier because you just only have to unpack once, and then you get to see all these different villages. There's great experiences along most of the rivers through there, and it's like you have your own floating hotel, which is great.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I was wondering about the other one as well, Antarctica. Are older Australians getting down there?
Yes, that's another huge growth point. Antarctica is becoming more and more popular. It is still an expensive holiday, not the cheapest place to go, but well worth the visit. I've had quite a few clients that have gone, and they've come back and they've said it was the most marvellous experience. There's a couple of ways that you can do it, because the crossing of the Drake Passage may not be the easiest thing to do. So there are some companies where you can fly down and fly back. or cruise one way and fly back the other way.
Wow. Yes, I'm sure on those big Antarctic stormy days it could be a little bit uncomfortable, even in the biggest of ocean-going vessels. So what then are some of the pitfalls, would you suggest, Tracy? I mean, if the oldies are really sort of testing themselves out a little bit, are they getting into scrapes? Are they getting into places where they shouldn't?
I think that there's always the possibility of that. I think the things that you do need to be careful of are a little bit of research always helps. So just make sure that you, where you're going, that you have the correct visas. The other thing is that sometimes when you have a lot of medications, and older Australians do have medications mostly, just to keep the box and make sure that it's packaged. So countries that might find that not the best, they have a label there. Check your passport validity and be careful of online bookings, because sometimes when they're making bookings online, there's no place to come back to. So if something goes wrong, you're sort of on your own. So it's always good to use a reputable travel agent.
Fantastic. And what about insurances as well for older Australians? Are they discriminated against?
I don't think that they're discriminated against. Insurance is a business, unfortunately, and it's all based on risk. And there's always insurance is available. In fact, at National Seniors, we do insure people up until 104. But I've rarely seen someone knocked back for insurance completely. In fact, probably only one person in 10 years. There could be some restrictions with pre-existing medical conditions. It's always careful. You need to be careful about that.
Wow. Well, we've heard that some of the older Aussies are interested in some of those more exotic destinations. Can I put you on the spot, Tracy, and ask you to nominate perhaps the number one destination that you would recommend?
That's a hard question. It's a very hard question. I would say maybe Canada and Alaska. It's a great mix. It gives people a huge difference of things that they can do, because you've got the beautiful Lake Louise and the amazing hotels that are there. The Rocky Mountaineer is an experience that most should be experienced, with the amazing mountains, etc. That would probably be my choice.
Sounds absolutely beautiful. And what about a couple of tips before we head off on this big overseas jaunt? Any special travel tips that you could give us before we let you go, Tracy?
I would say that it's always a good idea to keep copies of passports in your luggage, just in case something does go wrong. Another good thing would be if you are packing, or if you are travelling as a couple, to divide your luggage between two bags. It's going to be very rare that both bags are lost. So even though insurance will cover lost items, etc., it's always nice to have your own stuff. Pack lightly. You don't need what you think you will need, and take a good camera.
Fantastic. Fantastic tips, Tracy. Well, thank you so much indeed. Tracy Rivers from National Seniors Travel. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us on the H Stage today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. And that just about wraps it up for this week's edition of The Age Stage. Thank you very much indeed for your company. I'm Brendan Telfer. Paula Dunn and myself and the rest of the crew will be back at the same time next week. Hope you can join us.